Hey, what's up, guys? It's your host, Lopez, and I just want to say thank you for tuning into this episode today. If you're on Facebook and want to show some support with a like on the page, you can find it by going to facebook.com/behindcloseddoorspodcast or just searching Behind Closed Doors Podcast. You can also find it on Twitter at the BCD Podcast and on Instagram at the Behind Closed Doors Podcast. Last but not least, follow the podcast on Spotify by searching Behind Closed Doors in the podcast section to see all the amazing upcoming interviews I have to come. Every Sunday, I post a picture of a band with a hint of who my next guest is. Then on Tuesday, I post a brief clip from our video interview with a good highlight of our conversation we had. And lastly, post the new episode up on Spotify every Thursday morning. Now, on to the episode.
Some outdoor venue, but it's got limited, socially distanced seating. I can't remember the name of what it is, but I think we only can have like 1,300 people. So I'll let you lose your imagination. I don't really know. I don't have an itinerary yet, so I don't really know exactly where it is. But that'll be our first gig because we did one there in February of last year, and that was our last gig before we, got hit by the COVID.
Yeah. Well, we got Kenny Lewis, guitarist for Steve Miller Band. First and foremost, just want to start off by saying thank you for taking the time to talk with me tonight.
Oh, no problem. It's my pleasure. And is this being pre-recorded or are we live right now?
Yeah, just the, like we're, it's recording right now. It'll just be like a pre-record and then I'll edit it and then, you know, upload it, whatnot later on.
Okay.
So
I put my hearing aids in just because I'll be able to hear you a little better.
Not a problem.
There we go.
All good. Okay.
Yeah, Devin. So this is cool. Thanks for having me.
Hey, not a problem, buddy. Yeah, you're a huge fan. I am a very young guy compared to the typical people that have gotten into Steve Miller Band. So I'm in my mid to late 20s now, and
wow.
All the people, you know, I like stuff like got to catch Black Sabbath before they got to end and on their farewell tour, stuff like that. I wish I could have been able to been around to see, you know, you guys in your primes, Foghat, you know, the early days, just all those good music, all those groups like Heart and whatnot. So it's definitely a huge honor to be able to speak with somebody with, you know, in those times and be able to actually be able to hear some great stories and just go behind the scenes on some stuff.
Well, I'll do my best to try to dredge up some of those memories.
not a problem. So where are you originally from? Where did you grow up at?
Well, I was born in LA, in Pasadena, but my father, who worked for the state, got a promotion in 1960, and we moved up to the capital, Sacramento, which is where his office was. And I grew up there, which was very interesting place to grow up. We were about an hour and a half from San Francisco. We were about an hour and a half, 2 hours from Tahoe and the same to Shasta. So we were right in the middle of a lot of interesting geographical, outdoor-y, fun areas. But being near San Francisco and growing up during the Flower Power Fillmore days, I was able to get that wash coming over into Sacramento. And then, of course, pirate radio coming up from KSM from San Francisco with Tom Donahue. That was really an eye-opener for me, being able to pick up that station late at night in around 1966, 67, when everything was just starting to change. And that's where I first heard Steve Miller, was his first album, and, you know, a lot of original real blues records and, and of course all the other Bay Area, groups, Quicksilver, and, the Dead, at Jefferson Airplane. They were all getting signed at that time. That's when Steve and all of them got signed, Santana. They were all getting signed to record labels right around that time. And that was my education, was listening to that radio station and then trying to replicate some of that stuff in my own hometown there, playing parties as I started getting the bands a couple of years later.
So is that where you're living at now, currently still?
No, actually, I'm sorry, I didn't finish my story. So I went to there through school in my first year in college and played in the jazz band there at Cosumnes River College, and then got really good at reading notation. And I had a family of guys, one of which was the youngest son, who was the drummer in most of my bands in Sacramento. And they all lived in LA and they're all in the music business. And they had been having me come down every summer, to check out the studio scene and the whole thing down there, which is really exciting. So in the New Year's Day of 1973, I picked up and headed to LA to become a studio musician, which I did accomplish at some point, and then joined Steve Miller. And then eventually got tired of the LA scene when the studios scene had dried up, and other opportunities also dried up. And I moved up to San Luis Obispo, which is a little town, a little mission town that's halfway between LA and San Francisco on the coast. And I've been here for 15 years now. And, wine country, college town. We got Cal Poly here, and we're not far from Hearst Castle and those areas. So that's my genesis that I think that you wanted to hear.
Sounds pretty interesting. It's it's like for my area, there's not a whole lot going on here. It's about to get the transition over into spring. All the snow's melting. It's nice and soggy out everywhere you step, and it's just mucky out. And all the cars you see out here are just caked with salt. And cold weather's in the morning, so it's nothing too exciting over there. So I think your environment definitely tops off northern Indiana.
Well, it wasn't anything that was done by choice. It was just fortunate enough that my father was born in California. He was born in Alhambra in 1922, almost a century ago. And he, was a native son. And I just grew up thinking that everybody lived in California until I started touring, and I went, "Oh my God, there's actually people live out here in these states." Because I went on my first tour when I was 18, and we did end up playing Indiana. We played Fort Wayne. It was one of our last gigs, and that was the, I think, February or March of 1974 was my one and only early gig in Indiana.
Really? Yeah, I was just in Fort Wayne today too for work. That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. There was a hotel there that was at the time was a Sheraton. I don't know if it is now, but they had a lounge downstairs called the Brass Monkey, and I even got a picture I could send you of a band, the band I was in, and I think I was 19 by then. And it's an ad for the Brass Monkey, and it gives the hours of. We had a happy hour from 6 to 7, and then we played from 9 to 1:30. Like all the bands, and it was something. It was freezing. I remember,
Yeah.
but it was cold, but it was cold.
Yeah.
But that was like February, March, or something
Yeah,
like that.
this round, so sounds like it was around this time of year. It's definitely it, surprisingly enough, this year we've had just the easiest going winter. Usually we're getting like in January and February, we're getting at least, 3, 4 feet of snow throughout that month times period and getting below 20 degrees weather, and we got pretty
Well,
fortunate.
with global warming, it's going to be really weird all across the country all the time
Yeah.
until we fix this. Even Montana, where I have a cabin, had a pretty mild winter compared to what it normally has right on the Canadian border, which is very interesting. And then Texas gets hammered.
Right.
But yeah, that's you're going to see more of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you play the guitar. What got you into picking up the guitar in the first place?
Well, my brother and sister were folkies. They were kind of entertaining the family at family functions. My brother had a little guitar. In fact, it was this guitar right here, a
No
$40
kidding.
Sears Silvertone with no truss rod with a big fat neck. And he gave it to me years ago. But he used to play this, and I was too little to get my hands around it, But my sister and he would do, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and the Brothers Four, and Kingston Trio, that kind of stuff. I mean, folky music, Dylan and Ian and Sylvia. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they used to entertain the family, and I'd just sit over in the corner and sulk because I couldn't put my hand around a guitar. I couldn't say it. They were 6 and 7 years older than me. I was kind of a late child. So my aunt had a Martin ukulele up in her closet, left over from her college days, you know, the raccoon coats and the straw hats and all that stuff in the 1920s. And she wasn't playing it. And I just, you know, kept bugging her and bugging her, you know, can I play that? I want to try it. So finally, you know, she lived over in Berkeley in the Bay Area. So finally she relented one day and let me play it. And I fell in love with it because I get my hands around it. And then the next time I went, I begged her that I would, you know, borrow it and I'd bring it back. And of course I never did. but, you know, I went out and got a book and I started learning ukulele stuff. So that was kind of when it started. I was about 7, I think, when that happened.
So it started with ukulele and then it kind of progressed into the guitar.
Yeah. I mean, eventually I could get my hands around my brother's guitar and then I'd pull out his Peter, Paul and Mary songbooks and brother's 4 songbooks. And I'd put my fingers where the dots were and I started learning those. And my dad played a little guitar too, but he didn't really show me a lot. But I mean, we had one around when I was really little. I couldn't put my hand around it, but the ukulele is what got me going. But then I got bored of the ukulele. It didn't sound like rock and roll, you know, so I just let it go away. Then I played clarinet in the 3rd grade. And I just did that so I could learn how to read. And then I let that go. And then around the 6th grade, around 1966, is when I started picking up this guitar here and started playing those songbook songs. And then that's when the English invasion hit. So that was about 63, 64. And up until then, I'd been listening to Beach Boy records that my sister was playing all the time. So I was kind of a Beach Boy guy. But I hadn't played any electric guitar yet. So eventually I borrowed a guitar from a buddy of mine. His big brother had a guitar and an amp. They were sitting in their game room, just collecting dust, you know? So I went in there one day and kind of cried and bitched and moaned and said, you know, I got to play a talent show here and I don't have an instrument. I just wanted to borrow the guitar and the amp, you know, and I went through all this stuff. And it was like, he didn't want to do it, but I think one of his friends says, come on, let the kid borrow the guitar, you know?
Right.
You know? And so my next door neighbor at that time, this was in Sacramento, 1966, they lived in a house that had a bomb shelter, a real, you know, Cold War under the ground bomb shelter, you know, with bunk beds and had a little hand crank air thing, you know, it looked like a submarine going down in there. And we took our amps down there one summer with a 45 player. And it was the summer between 66, 67, I think, or I guess it was 67. I don't know. But we just started copying all these records, you know, Gloria and, you know, Secret Agent Man and, you know, just all the hits, you know, Satisfaction or whatever was the hit at that time, the Monkees, you know, and we just started playing down there and we would turn our amps all the way up. We wouldn't bother anyone. And that's where I kind of learned, was in that bomb shelter in that summer.
What a place to learn the guitar at. What was the first guitar you actually owned? Was it your brother's guitar?
No, he didn't give that to me until just about 20 years ago. First guitar that I owned, it was actually my own guitar, was right around that same time, right after I came out of the bomb shelter. I knew I had to get my own because the guy wanted his guitar back, you know, and he was kind of a big guy and he was going to kick my ass if I didn't get that. I had to give that. There was a Harmony guitar and a Harmony amp and single pickup, you know, it was okay. And I went down, my dad owed me some money because he borrowed some money to buy an outboard motor for a sailboat. So it was from an inheritance I had. He took the money out of my bank account without asking me. So that was the first time I ever realized about the funniness about people's addictions with their toys and money. And this would affect me into my adulthood, of course, you know, but he promised he'd pay me back. And I had a paper out at the time and I raised some money. And then also I had that clarinet. That was the other thing I forgot to mention. My aunt had a clarinet, or my cousin had a clarinet. And the aunt let me have that because he wasn't playing that. So I had a clarinet. So I'd play it once in a while, but I wasn't doing anything with it. So I sold that for $40. My dad owed me $50. I had another, I don't know, 10 or 15 bucks saved up from my paper out. And my dad took me down to a pawn shop in Sacramento on K Street and Saul Anapolsky's pawn shop. I actually went to school with his kids. And he used to go there to buy like little trinkets, like, mood rings and pinky rings and things like that. And he knew Saul, and he knew that he could probably wheel a deal with him. So we went down there, and there was this beautiful red Gibson semi-hollow body guitar hanging in the window. It was either a 330 or a 335. I can't remember which model it was, but it was red, so it was one of those. And it was $135. And of course, I didn't have 135. I had about 115 or whatever, at my disposal. But that was for a guitar with no amp, So then Saul goes, "Well, why don't you get this one? It looks just as cool." And he showed me this Japanese guitar. It was called a Kanora. It had like a Fender 6-inline headstock, but like a 335 kind of body, with real cheap single coil pickups. And he says, "I can get you this guitar and this amp." And he shows me this amp. It was a Melody amp. And I think it had vibrato in it and reverb. It's probably like 5 or 10 watts. I think it had 2 8-inch speakers. And he could give me this guitar and this amp for $135, same price as the red guitar. So I had to make, and then of course my dad's, "Well, that's too much too." And I go, "Come on, Dad." So I finally got him to say that he would cover for the extra money to make the buy, and I needed an amp. So I had to make up my mind to walk out of there with a Gibson, really great guitar with no amp, or get out of there with a Japanese rig for the same price with an amp. And so, of course, I went for the one with the amp. So I didn't get a really good guitar until another year later or two. But that was my first guitar, a Kenora Japanese guitar. And surprisingly enough, those are worth money now. I actually saw that same guitar on eBay a while back, and I took a picture of it. It was just the body. We didn't even have the neck because it had a bolt-on neck. The body was $500 with no electronics or anything in it. So those guitars are going for like $750 to $1,000 now for those goofy Japanese guitars. Isn't that funny?
It's crazy, ain't it? You don't have it now, though.
No. I had to trade that. That's a whole other story. But I mean, yeah, that lasted the first year. But I did customize it. I did practice a lot and play on it, and I did get pretty good on it. I mean, it was not a terrible guitar. It was just not a really great guitar. It was like, think like one of those Gretsch Electromatic guitars that they sell today, or Ibanez Art Deco. It was like that, but not even that good. Because in those days, they were all made by hand, and you never knew what you were getting. At least nowadays, everything's done with Plectrum, CAT scan digital, machines and stuff. So it's got,
It's pretty advanced, yeah.
at least it's consistent, So there you go. That's the genesis on the first guitar.
Now, what guitars do you play now?
The ones I play now primarily are a 1960 Heavy Relic custom shop Fender Strat. I play about a 6-year-old K-line Telecaster that's kind of aged, and it's kind of like a 51 Tele sound, but it's got rosewood, so it's, a little different, but it's really nice. I play a 58 custom shop Gibson reissue 335. That I had picked at Wildwood in Colorado. I play just a standard SG, standard, Gibson. I play, I'm trying to think. Oh, and I play a Gretsch Chinese knockoff Gretsch 6120, kind of a Brian Setzer looking thing that I actually customized and built. Those are the main electric guitars I play, and then of course I have acoustics as well. But those are the main ones that kind of come to the gigs nowadays.
Are you endorsed by Gibson then?
No, I was endorsed by Epiphone for a while, and I had quite a few Epiphones, and they've kind of come and gone over the years. I still have one of their jazz guitars. I have a one of those Broadway Zephyr Emperor or whatever they are, single coil. It's like a Johnny Smith pickup in the neck position, single coil, and big body. It's 17 inch, and so I used to play that in the big band here in town. I still have that, and I'm trying to think if I have any of the other phones. A couple of them got sold. I had them on the road, and they got it in Steve's road case, and they ended up going back to his warehouse. And then he had a sell-off one summer when he wanted to get rid of some guitars, and I hadn't been playing them, although they were bringing them out on the road. I wasn't playing them that much, and he thought they were his, so he sold them. So I got him back. I said, "Oh man, you sold my headphones. You got to give me something else." So he got me another Don Grosch, because I was playing Don Grosch with him at the time, and I think I got. He bought me a National Reso Electric Dobro style electric guitar. So I got a couple back. So, and much better than what he sold. So,
so again, it worked out in your favor then.
Yes, yes. So those are the ones that I play mostly on gigs nowadays. But with him now, as you know, I'm his bass player. And when I play bass with him, I use a bass company called Sandberg. And they're made in Germany. And the ones that I have just look like Fender knockoffs. And they're really great. They're five-string, P-bass, Sandberg guitars. They have a pickup in the bridge position too. So they're kind of like a special, like a PJ special. But they're five-strings. And they're just really roadworthy and really great. And the necks are not too wide, which is really nice. One of the problems I was having when I was just going over to five-string was that my hands are not huge. You know, they're just normal size. And most five-string basses, even the like defenders and stuff, they're just gigantic at the 12th fret. You can't get around on them. So the Ibanez makes some that are nice, slim neck ones. And I've actually made a couple basses with slimmer neck five-string necks. But the Sandberg is almost too big, but it's about at the right spot. And so that's the one I play with Steve.
So you're the bassist for the Steve Miller Band. You're not the guitarist?
Correct.
Okay.
I hope it doesn't break your heart. For 28 years, I was his guitar player. And most of the videos you see on YouTube, I'm playing guitar with him. And on the bands that I lead around here, I play guitar. But with Miller, I played bass on a couple of his albums. In fact, the first record I did with him, Abracadabra, I played bass on quite a few of the tracks. But he had forgotten that I was a bass player. And so our bass player broke his ankle in about five places about 11, 12 years ago. I think it was 2009 or 10. And he was incapacitated, couldn't stand. And we were in the middle of a tour. And so that's when Steve had me jump over to bass to fill in while we're waiting for our bass player to come back. And when he heard my bass playing, he just went, "Oh my God." He goes, "You got to stay on bass." So I became his bass player that day. So it was pretty funny.
That is funny.
So and we hired a guitar player to take my place. So I was fired and hired on the same day. You know?
So how did the replacement come about with new guitars? Everything worked pretty smoothly?
Yeah, we actually played without another guitar player for a while. And then also our keyboard player started playing some keyboard basses. So I'd go over to guitar on some songs where he really needed guitar backup. And that worked out for a while. If you look at Austin City Limits, I think it's 2010 or something like that. That was the incarnation where I was jumping back and forth between bass and guitar. And then when we were there playing that gig in Austin, a guitar player friend of mine and also a guitar player who had opened for us with an artist named Curtis Salgado out of Oregon. He was his guitar player, and Steve knew who he was, but at that time, of course, I was just friends with him. We'd both been doing Guitar Center gigs prior to this, because when I came back in the Steve Miller Band, I'm going back too far. Steve took a break from 2000 to 2004. He just got really fed up with, you know, SFX, you know, and there were the people that owned all the venues at the time. And then Napster was real big, and he was having all of his records stolen, and, you know, he wasn't getting any royalties for all that sharing, file sharing and whatnot. So he quit for a while and he went home. And when that happened, I went to work for Guitar Center. And that's when I met this guy who used to open for us prior to that break by the name of Jacob Peterson, who had been with Curtis Salgado, who had opened up for us in, like, I don't know, 1998, 97. I can't remember now. But anyway, we remained friends. I helped him get a job at Guitar Center because I was working in the Hollywood store. So when we were in Austin, going fast forwarding to this 2010, a debut of the Moody Theater there, I called him because I wanted to get a taco that night. And Uber wasn't really going yet. It was 2010. I think maybe it was just getting started, but I didn't want to get a taxi to go buy a taco at a taco truck after the gig. So I invited my friend Jacob to come with his wife because I thought maybe we could all go get tacos together afterwards, you know, and use his car. And that was the real reason why I called him. You know? I said, and I'm buying, you know. And so I invited him to come to the show, and it was a private gig because it was the debuting of the theater, and all the donors that had contributed to building this new facility. It was a private party for them, and there wasn't any tickets for the band. We were getting paid well, we were getting treated well, but we just didn't have any seats. So I invited him to come and wear a laminate. You know, I don't know if you're aware of what a laminate is, but you know, you get a VIP laminate, you can hang around backstage. He was like, "You mean I don't get a seat?" And I went like, "No, man, you're just going to hang on the side of the stage." He goes, "Well, I don't want to do that." You know, so I kind of kept talking to him, and I said, "Well, go ask your wife, you know, and see if she wants to go out, you know, and have a good time. I'll pay for tacos and all this stuff." And that's when he finally went, all right. So they come and they're hanging out in the green room. And at that time, our harmonica player, Norton Buffalo, had just passed away from lung cancer. And he was the top harmony that was on all this harmony stacks for the band, you know. And so we really missed him. And the keyboard player had to move up to his part. I kind of moved up the keyboard part. And we were missing a member. We didn't have a bass player. We didn't have, we didn't have another guitar player at that point. I guess I was the bass player. So Steve recognizes Jacob. And he doesn't remember his name. He's backstage and he sees the kid. And he goes, "I remember that kid. What's his name?" I said, "That's Jacob. Remember, he's played for Curtis Delgado." Went, "Oh, yeah." He goes, "He plays clean, doesn't he?" And I went, "Yeah. He plays kind of like Robert Cray," you know, which was kind of the style of the Northwest sound at that time. And he went, you know, because Steve always likes a guy who plays clean, because he wants to be the only one that sticks the fuzz tone on, you know. He didn't want anybody else having all the sustain and all the groovy tone, you know. So he went out and talked to him in the hallway, and we were all getting ready to do our vocal warm-ups before doing the show. Our manager wasn't there. He was already at the front of the house because he mixes our front of the house as well as manages us. And Steve comes up to me after talking to Jake about in the home, and he goes, because we all had lists of people that we were going to have audition for this slot that we needed to fill. You know, we were going to invite our friends, you know, people we knew. I didn't know Jacob that well. And so he goes, "I just talked to that Jacob guy out in the hallway, and he says he sings tenor." I went, "Yeah, okay." He goes, "What do you think about him coming in the band full time and you playing bass full time?" And I went like, "Okay." I said, "Maybe we could have a band meeting and discuss this in a couple of days, but we got to go on stage right now." And he was like going, And he gets this light bulb over his head that I see sometimes with Steve, and I go, "Uh-oh, here we go." And so he goes up and gets Jacob, and he drags him into our vocal warm-ups, and he makes him do the vocal warm-ups with us. And Jacob had not been singing. He had been playing in bands around Austin at the time, but he wasn't a singer much at that time. But he could, his tone was a tenor tone, and Steve had him doing the vocal warm-ups, you know, say all a mine, you know, "It's a beautiful day," and all these little things, you know. And he's like, you know, hoarse. He can't hit the notes and stuff, and Steve keeps going, no, make your throat like this, you know, open your mouth, get your teeth forward, you know, get your cheeks up, you know. He's like, you know, molding this kid while with vocal warm-ups, and then getting him to sing and play, sing some of these notes. And right as we're about ready to take the stage, he turns to all of us and he says, "You know what, Jacob, I think you could do this gig." You know, and we all had lists of friends that we wanted to audition for the band, right? He goes, "I think you could do this gig. I'm going to offer you the gig for the Steve Miller Band right now. I'll see you in a minute." No. We go up on stage. And that's the way Jacob got hired. And he replaced me, per se, and I recorded my show on guitar with all my vocals and my guitar parts. And I gave that to Jacob, and he woodshed it and he learned it. So that's how that went about, to answer your question.
That is crazy. That is funny, though. That's what a story.
Yeah. And we did go get the tacos.
I was going to say the tacos.
But they were catatonic. He and his wife were just like, because he had just gotten in a band that was actually making pretty good money. He got in some rich oil baron's son's band, and he was like getting paid $2,500 a month to rehearse, and you know, and play and working at Guitar Center at the same time. So he was actually making some decent money for the first time in a long time. So when he got offered this, it was just like, "Oh my God, I better give up all that. Now I got to join this band," you know. And I sat him down and his wife, and I gave them the whole 9 yards of what Steve was going to be like working for, what it was going to be like being in the band. And everything I told him over the next 10 years came true. And he always comes up to me once in a while, goes, you know, they remember that night you were telling me? I didn't even believe that was ever going to happen. Man, it happened. And I went like, yep.
That is funny.
So, yeah, he's been in the band about, well, I guess it would be, you know, about 12 years now.
So songs, well, jumping into songs with the band, although the song that I'm going to, a couple of the songs I'm going to mention were before you had joined, I'm sure you can still get kind of a hindsight on, like, the creative process on it and, like, what you, in your opinion, thinks makes it such classic hit. So the first one, obviously, that I'm sure you get a lot of question about is The Joker. It's sitting right now currently on Spotify at 250 million streams and had been certified platinum in the U.S. That song is definitely a classic song that is widely known and without a doubt is a catchy tune. So like I said, in your opinion, what do you think makes that song stick out so greatly?
Well, obviously the wolf whistle. You know, that's the thing that everybody gets connected to. Yeah. That's a real American male thing that you just hear and you just go, oh, yeah. You know, right. You just like totally get it. You know, you could just hear that just flipping through the dial and go like, wait a minute, what was that? You know, and then, of course, you know, the Peaches Shake Your Tree line was a line that was in old American blues folklore. And it was actually a public domain line. Originally, the lyric was done by a guy named Eugene Powell. He wrote a song called Sitting on Top of the World. And the lyric was, if you don't like my peaches, then don't shake my tree. That was the original line. And Steve just turned it around and made it a positive thing. Like he always does. He always likes to take minor blues songs and sing them in major. La, 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 la. You know, I mean, everything's happy, you know, because he was really influenced by the Four Freshmen and the Beach Boys, you know. So that's that song with that line is a really popular line. Of course, it was popular back in the 20s and 30s when it was originally written as well, but that was only heard in juke joints and stuff. So he put it into commercial AM radio pop music and it became very popular. Lovey Dovey was actually a name of a song that the president for Atlantic Records was a guy named Ahmet Ertegun. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he started Atlantic Records, you know, and had Ruth Brown and Ray Charles and, you know, all those people. He owned the publishing on a song called Lovey Dovey. And the lyrics in that song were, I really like your peaches, I want to shake your tree. Somebody had already taken that and made it positive back in the 50s. So Steve, unfortunately, had to endure a lawsuit over the song because of that lyric and the fact that the song was called Lovey Dovey, and he was singing Lovey Dovey all the time. And had he had the right lawyer, a really good music lawyer, they could have pleaded the case that the lyric was a public domain lyric left over from old blues songs that were older than 50 years. So unfortunately, he didn't have that representation and he had to split the song with Ahmet. That being said, what your question is that all those ingredients that made it a hit is what got him in trouble with the lawsuit. So that is why it's a hit, because it was already a hit. It was a hit before he even used those lyrics, you know. But the cat call on the guitar was probably the thing that really put it over the top. And that was an original Steve thing. And he's got the short delay on that with the wah-wah, and it's really loud in the mix. And in fact, when it's fading, it's turned way up as it's fading. You get it one more time. You know, it's like, it's just hooks, you know. It's what it is. And then the fact that he said he was a midnight toker at a time when marijuana was still illegal was a pretty bold thing for a guy to do, you know, on a commercial pop song. And even though it kind of went over the heads of most, you know, censor people, if, you know, especially the RIAA radio censors and everything, I don't even think they got that. You know, they didn't even know what toke meant. You know, that's the reason why one toke over the line, Sweet Jesus, went on Lawrence Welk, because they didn't even know, you know.
Right.
So those three elements, Steve always had a rule when we were writing and doing songs, like on the Abracadabra album and afterwards, he told me, he goes, you know, all songs have to have three hooks, three things that are memorable, that repeat, that, you know, are that make the song indelibly hooky. And so those were your three hooks, the catcall, the peaches, and the toker. Those are the three big, and then just the sound of his voice, you know, was a hook in itself. But the way the song was mixed too is a contributor because it doesn't have a lot of reverb. It's a real nice, dry, simple, great lead vocal up front, your face kind of tune, which holds up on today's radio because, you know, that's kind of the way a lot of people record. It could be a John Mayer song. Who knows, you know? It could be Jack Johnson. It could be, you know, whoever's the flavor of the week, you know?
Right, right.
But, yeah, that's the reason why it was a hit. And, but you know what? I was a Steve Miller fan from the record one. And when he came out with that song, I was really angry. I didn't like the song. I thought he'd sold out. He was doing commercial pop music now. And all of his other albums prior to that had a lot, you know, usually had some political message and or had blues. And that song doesn't have either of those. You know, it's just a pop song, you know, that's hooky. And so I stopped buying his records when The Joker came out. Pretty funny. But then when Fly Like an Eagle came out, that's when I went, wow, that's cool. And then I went out and bought that record.
That's what I was going to say. The next song runner up to that on Spotify streams is Fly Like an Eagle, which is sitting at 88 million streams. And of course, that was another great song. For songs like that, what was the feelings for you to listen to it back in the day when it first came out and then to where you are now being in the band and actually playing those songs?
Well, I was working in the Chitlin circuit, kind of in the ghetto, and I was always kind of becoming a studio musician at that time too. I was just starting, so I was kind of immersed in R&B, and I was playing in black clubs and stuff on bass. And when I heard "Fly Like an Eagle" and I heard Lonnie Turner's line on the bass and stuff, and the beat, and you know Gary Malibur's drum beat, I just went, wow, that's really cool. And sure enough, that song crossed over into R&B charts. It actually got play on black stations because they just thought it was so cool. And that's really what got me back into listening to him. And then, of course, Jungle Love was another one because it was so zany. And the lyrics were great. But Steve didn't write that. That was actually Lonnie Turner and Greg Douglas, the guitar player that I replaced in the band. They wrote that song. So those two songs in particular got me interested in listening. And then Rockin' Me was cool. It didn't turn me on as much as the others because Rockin' Me just sounds kind of like a Chuck Berry Beach Boys song, you know. And but then Jet Airliner was interesting, and he didn't write that one either. That was actually Paul Pena. And that was really cool. I really dug that. And then Take the Money and Run was cool because it was a story song. So that was kind of like a country song. So it had a story. And then, you know, whenever you get a story song, you're probably going to get some airplay. And so that was cool. And then Swing Town, you used to hear it on sports events, shows and things. And it was kind of cool. The synthesizer at the end sounds kind of like, you know, an oboe or something. You know, so that's an unusual, like Telstar. I grew up with Telstar, which was a big hit in 1962, I think it was, which had a synthesizer that sounded like that. You know, that was a big anthem tune that was a hit back in then by the, God, what were they called? I can't remember. Hurricanes or something like that. I can't remember. But anyway, so those songs stuck out. So when I heard them on the radio for the first time, especially Fly Like an Eagle, I went like, wow, Steve's really gotten back into it now. He's doing some stuff because, you know, the lyrics in Fly Like an Eagle had a little bit of a political message. It wasn't so much against any particular, you know, faction, but it just said, you know, you got to feed the children, put shoes on their feet and take people off the street. And that's still going on today, you know, so that song holds up today.
Now, what are some proud moments for you with the band?
Well, I was asked this actually yesterday on an interview, and I had to think about it for a minute. The very first one that really, really just brought it home for me, and I'm sure most artists that play at this venue probably feel the same. But I don't know if you're aware of it, but Steve Miller's godfather was Les Paul. And Les Paul sort of was like a, you know, big brother, other uncle kind of guy in his life, helped him with his, you know, his problems with Capitol Records because Les had been at Capitol and all that stuff. And we were close with Les, and we used to go sit in with him at his gig in Midtown Manhattan at the Iridium on Monday nights. And I even got to go to his house at one point, see all of his inventions down the basement, got to see the log, the original guitar and all that. And so he was turning 90, and the city of New York and Carnegie Hall decided to do a 90th birthday party tribute for him at Carnegie Hall. And we were invited to play there. So we got to go to Carnegie Hall and got to sit backstage with all these great players that were all invited. Met Tommy Emmanuel backstage and Pat Martino and Bucky Pizzarelli and his son. And if I'm not mistaken, I think either Joe Satriani or Neil Sean. I think Neil Sean might have played. And there was a lot of who's who players. So there were jazz players, there were acoustic players, there were rock players. And we got to play and to play on this Carnegie Hall stage and go downstairs and have a drink at that bar where all the, you know, Benny Goodman and everybody had drink back in the 30s and stuff. I mean, it was just a cool experience. And and my father, who was a wannabe swing musician, he had always used to play the Benny Goodman live album recorded at Carnegie Hall that had Swing Sing 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 on it, you know, with Gene Krupa's drum solo and all that. So my dad was still alive when we played there, and he was just so proud. So that was a big moment for me to be able to tell my dad, who of course had very, very worried about me being a rock guitar player early on, you know, like, you know, you're going to ruin your life and all that stuff, you know. So for me to be able to say, Dad, I just played Carnegie Hall, check it out. He was just like, damn.
Yeah, that's definitely a milestone to reach right there and be able to tell, you know, yeah, like you said, tell your dad. And he's like, well, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea for you to do.
Yeah, he kind of, near the end of his life, you know, he gave my brother and I both a nod, you know, that he was proud of both of us. And that was kind of nice because my brother went into the corporate world. He's a whole other animal than me. Although my brother was a player. I mean, this was his guitar that I just showed you. I mean, he was a folky. He didn't particularly like the English Invasion stuff, but he kind of liked the Beach Boys and Janet Dean. That's where he kind of drew the line, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was like a beer-drinking frat boy, you know, with this triad and the red blazer. So when the Mop Tops came out, and they were, you know, eventually came the Beatles that we saw, you know, in 1969, for crying out loud. I mean, he didn't want anything to do with it. So it was pretty funny. So the other moment would have been my own personal moment, which was when we played the Royal Albert Hall in London. Goodbye Cream had been recorded there. And that was one of my favorite Cream albums. Of course, I was a Clapton nut. Hendrix and Cream and Jeff Beck were my three favorite rock guitar players that I grew up listening to. So when I got to play there at Royal Albert Hall, and then we had David Gilmour, who's a friend of Steve's, he was backstage in the green room while we were doing the show. And I was hanging out talking with Steve and David Gilmour all night. I mean, what a thrill.
Yeah.
Those were two crowning moments, you know, in my time spent with Steve.
Crazy stuff. I wouldn't know what to do if I was to be.
And then, of course, number one. I mean, the album I did with him went number one. I mean, it went number, that single went number one. And I had three songs I co-written on the album and sold 5 million copies. So I bought a house, you know, so that was cool too. But that was just a business, you know, milestone. But these other two were the psychological milestones.
Definitely. So let's talk a little bit about live performances. You guys have toured with some amazing bands and acts such as ZZ Top, Grateful Dead, the Doobie Brothers, Pat Benatar, Merle Haggard, and more. What was it like to play alongside some of these amazing, amazing bands?
You know, I mean, when you're a kid and you're learning how to play and you're kind of coming up and all these bands are like your idols, you know, you put it in your head that you're just not even going to be able to do it. You know, I mean, you're like, I'll just fall apart. I'll just melt like a Hershey bar on a sidewalk in a summer day, you know. But when you become a professional and you start getting a little hard, you start having a few record deals that go sour, you get a couple lawyers that screw you over, and you know, and you start getting a little tough. By the time I met some of these bands you just mentioned, I was just kind of like them. I was just another person on the rock pile trying to make it, you know. And we all have to eat in the same catering, you know, we all have to share the same crappy trailers in the back of the venue, you know, for our dressing rooms. And you know, sometimes you have to go into porta potty to go number two, you know.
Yeah.
with all those guys you just mentioned, you know, because when you're on location on the gig, I mean, you have your bus, but even the bus is a leased bus usually. You can't go number two on the bus.
Right.
Because the drivers don't want to have anything to do with that, you know. Right. So we all end up going to the catering, eating the bad chicken, and end up going to the Andy Gump, you know. So it's you get equalized. You all become friends, and you don't really go all gaga, and you don't even really necessarily get all those photos, at least not right off the bat. Because when you do that, it kind of spoils the camaraderie. Because then you become a fanboy. You know, and you don't want to be a fanboy around those guys. You just want to be looked at as just an equal.
Right.
Then, exactly. Then they'll call you and they'll invite you into their bus and they'll even introduce you to their families and hang and talk and, you know, talk about other subjects and stuff. Because they know you're safe. You're not just going to sit and get in their lap and go, oh, man, I can't believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Because they get that all day long.
Yeah, you know, exactly. So, they don't want to have to tour on that.
So, to answer your question, it was just going to work and punching the time clock with those guys.
And yeah, it's I could, yeah, I when I ask more bigger bands, you know, that have been known more, and I ask them that type of stuff, I kind of get the same reaction, and it's understandable because nobody wants, you know, like you said, you get fans and stuff like that all the time. You don't want to have a fellow band that you're touring with do that every single night, you know, just like stare, watch you sleep, and you know.
Yeah. Like Paul McCartney, for instance, is a good friend of Steve's, and I've met him several times. And one time we were at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills, and this was, you know, I don't know, I want to say 10 years ago, something like that, 10 or 12 years ago. And he had started getting gray, and he dyes his hair, as you know. And it, when he's off tour, he doesn't dye it, you know. And he was there with his new girlfriend at the time. He'd broken up with that strange woman, the one that, you know, was backing the, you know, the poor kids that had their arms and legs blown up by mines and all this. I can't remember her name, but he was only married to her for a short time. It was kind of a catastrophe. So he was kind of not dating for a while. And then all of a sudden he was dating this new woman. And my wife and myself and my youngest daughter were walking down the hall. We just come from the pool. And this gray haired guy with sunglasses sees my daughter, who has a James Jamerson bass player Shadows of Motown t-shirt on that I was given that she wore. And it had a picture of James Jamerson, the famous bass player, and all the Motown hits on it. And there's only certain people who would ever recognize who this was. And we're walking down the hall and this gray haired guy comes up and Diane and I know him. Diane was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds in the Sergeant Pepper movie. She knows Peter. I mean, she knows Paul. And we didn't recognize him. And he comes up to my daughter and he goes, you know, that's a wonderful shirt you're wearing there, young lady. He goes, that's a real bass player right there. You know, and he goes, carry on, you know, and he keeps walking. And we're walking to our room and my daughter's kind of in this catatonic stare, you know. And of course, she had just started getting into the Beatles around that time and was focusing on what they looked like, you know. And so I turn to my wife and I go, that was interesting. That fellow, he knew who James Jamerson was. I said, I bet you he's in the music business. It was Paul McCartney. And my daughter pokes me. She goes, Dad, that was Paul McCartney. And I went, nah, that wasn't him. It doesn't look anything like, I mean, he had a little iguana beard, double chin. You know, he had a beard. His hair was this color, you know. Because this is what my hair looks like now on my beard. My hair is still natural. This is natural color. But my beard is all gray. So his whole hair and everything was almost like this. So I just didn't recognize him because I'd met him years earlier. We had done a gig at the Hollywood Bowl for Earth Day, and I'd met him that night. I actually got to sing on stage with him with Diane. And at that, of course, that night, he just looked like Paul, and he had dark hair and the whole bit. So I had met him before, and he just didn't look anything like that guy, you know. So it was pretty funny. So to get back to what you were saying and what we were talking about, my wife goes, well, take Kendra down there and get a signature, you know, get a picture with him. And I went like, no, I don't think so. We're not going to do that. I said, what I'll do, though, is I'll take her there and I'll introduce her to him, and that'll be it. And sure enough, we went down by the pool, and he was not at the pool, but he was in the exercise area, which is right next to the pool in the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills. And he was on a treadmill, and there wasn't anybody in there, but his girlfriend was kind of reading a book, sitting over on a chair or something. He was trying to get the treadmill working, and he sees me coming out the corner of his eye with my daughter, and I could tell he was kind of looking and He was like, kind of like, oh God, here we go. He had that kind of look. And I just, before I got to him, I went, Paul, Kenny Lee, Steve Miller Band. He went, eh, no fucking way. You know, and it's like, you know, he knew who I was because we'd met years earlier. And of course, he and Steve are friends. And so I bring, you know, Kendra over and I just say, yeah, you know, we just got through playing the Greek. And, you know, I thought I recognized you in the hall. Of course, I lied. he goes, wait, is Steve in the hotel? I go, yeah, he's here. Just look under his alias that he stays under. He goes, that's fantastic. And I said, I bet you were here for the Hollywood Bowl gig again because they had, oh God, what's her name? Famous R&B singer. Anyway, she was singing with the Pops there that the night before, and she was doing some Beatle tunes. And I guess he'd come in to see her, and that's why he was there. He was just kind of on vacation. But that's why he wasn't, you know, all duded up and everything, you know. And so I introduced my daughter, and she was very cool, and he was very nice. And, you know, and the next time I see him, because of the way I handled that situation, I didn't ask for a signature. I didn't ask for a picture. He'll know that I'm safe, and he'll just say, come on, let him in, you know, because he knows who I am and what I do, you know, and that I'm not going to go all gaga.
Right, exactly.
So that's just an example of both of us not on stage, not in the green room, but behaving in the same way.
Absolutely. Now, when you do go on tours, what's a typical day in the life like for you when you, like, from the start of a day to the end of the day for a tour for you?
Well, if we're in a new town, I'll explore. You know, I'll go out walking around. If we're in a town where I know where things are, I might go visit some of the places I've been to before, either to eat or, you know, a kooky, you know, thrift store or a, you know, something. I might even go fishing. If there's a river nearby, I fish all the time. So if there's a river nearby, man, I'm fishing. I might even get up to crack of dawn and go fishing. But, you know, maybe work out in the gym. Most of the hotels have decent gyms. We stay at pretty nice places, so, you know, we usually get a gym. And then we'll get a lobby call, like, around 2 p.m., and we'll head on over to the gig, and we'll have lunch there, which will be catered. Now, you could eat lunch in town, too, if you're in a really great southern town. You might want to get some barbecue, you know, or you might want to get some sushi if you're in New York City, or you might get, you know, depending on where you are. If you're in Seattle, you're going to get some crab, you know, or whatever. And you have per diem that you're given to do that. So you might have lunch before you go to soundcheck. But we go there, we'll have lunch. And if you haven't eaten, you know, you'll eat, or you'll have a salad, let's say. And then we'll do soundcheck. And soundcheck's usually from about 3 to 4. And then Steve shows up, and then he'll do his soundcheck, which lasts about 10, 15 minutes. And then we might rehearse a song, you know, and that'll go to about maybe 5:15, something like that. And then we break, and then we go either back to the hotel, if the hotel is nearby, or if we're out in the middle of nowhere, we'll just go to our bus and we'll just chill, or maybe back to catering and then have dinner in catering. And that's where you might run into the Doobie Brothers, or,
right.
You know, ZZ Top, or, you know, sit and have a conversation with Billy Gibbons about how the salsa sucks or something.
Yeah. You
know? And then they are usually the opener, and they are going to go get dressed and go do their sound check. And then they get ready to play. And we're still killing time because, you know, we usually close the show. So we'll be hearing them playing when we're still goofing around on the bus, or I might even take a nap. Who knows? Or I'll go fishing if it's an outdoor gig.
Right.
And if it's an early outdoor gig after dinner at sundown, the fish are coming out again. So I'll go fishing all the way up until downbeat. You know, until I just have to put my clothes on, get ready to go on stage. So those are, you know, that's an example of what a day might be like.
What's the craziest thing that you've seen or that's happened to you on a tour?
The craziest thing seen. Well, there's a couple incidences I can think of. One of the things that we did on the Abracadabra, off the success of the Abracadabra tour, I should say, in 1984, we played a show in Germany called Rockpalast. And anybody out there who's in the music business probably knows what it is. It's, you know, was kind of like one of the early festival things, you know, like Lollapalooza or, you know, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, Coachella, you know, that kind of a thing. And Steve wanted to really do it up. We were headlining. Somehow we finagled to get the headliner slot. with a bunch of bands, including U2, who had been our opening act on the Abracadabra tour in 1982. But in 1984, they were pretty big by then. Stray Cats, Joe Cocker, Mink DeVille, Tom Tom Club, you know, Talking Heads, Dave Edmonds. These were all the acts who were on the show that day. And U2 was the last band before us, and we were going to close. It was, I think it was Joe Cocker, U2, and then us. And Steve, when we got this slot, he decided he wanted to really do it up because, you know, he really likes to get into a great stage setup sometimes. He was one of the first guys to use lasers back in like 1977 when he was touring on the Fly Like an Eagle album. He wanted to do a disappearing magic act with a tiger. And we went to London about a month before the gig, and we rehearsed in a theater there near Kensington High, Regent's Park. And we hired a guy from Connecticut who was an escape artist, magic guy, and he built this thing that was going to allow Steve to walk up a little stairwell and get inside a cage with little drapes. And there was going to be a Bengal tiger on the back of it with a false plywood black wall that was on hinges that the audience would not see. When you'd open up this thing, because they brought out the thing and they'd spin it around on wheels and you could see everything from all angles, blah, blah, blah. And you could see underneath it because it was on stilts, but it was going to have this Bengal tiger in it, in this false back. So in the back, the drapes were closed. And the false back with this plywood door was about, you know, I don't know, 2.5 feet forward, just enough to look at the Bengal tiger in there, which they would drug to where it was just kind of like stuck in there until this thing fell forward. Anyway, the way the act worked is that Steve would go up the little steps that were like also on wheels to get into the cage that had, you know, locking door like a cage, and he would get inside and they would pull the they would leave the stairs. That's right. They would leave the stairs. And then he would play a little bit with a guitar and he would go like this to the audience. And then he would shut the drapes and then he would open up a trap door on the floor, which would go into that little stairwell that was on wheels. And so he would get into that and then he would pull a string that would allow the false wall to fall forward to allow the Bengal tiger to come into the cage that had the drapes closed already. So once he got inside the stairwell, the two beautiful German, you know, Vanna White looking assistants were supposed to pull it out from underneath this stilted cage and pull it off to the side of the stage. So now you'd see everything you'd see under, and then they'd spin it around again, you know. So, you know, it was one of those kind of, it was like a David Copperfield. So the problem was, is that when we did the rehearsal in England, the weeks before with the very cage, we didn't have a tiger. We didn't have the tiger, you know, so we would just go through all the motions of him going into the stairwell, pulling the false thing forward and the tiger coming forward, but we didn't have the tiger. So this tiger was huge. I mean, it had to be like, I don't know, what are they, 400 or 500 pounds? I mean,
there's some big cats.
It was huge. So what happened was that the floor of this thing was made out of plywood. Okay. And it was good plywood. It's probably marine plywood or so, but when 400 or 500 pounds gets on it, it bends down. So the tiger came out and moved to the front because they were just getting ready to reveal, you know, show that it was that Steve had turned into a tiger. And they couldn't pull a stairwell out because the plywood was now pushing down on the top of the stairwell and the stairwell was stuck underneath the cage. Now, Steve had on a tux, so he was not only clean, but he was also hot. This was in August. So he was really, really hot, and he was really stuffy because he had a tie on, a bow tie, and the whole bit, and he was stuck in this thing. And what do they do to, you know, with cats to get him to behave is they give him a tranquilizer. And what does a tranquilizer do? It makes your bowels loose.
Oh, no.
Your bladder loose. So now Steve's stuck in the stairwell and the cat comes out. They can't pull the stair thing, but they have to go through with the act. So they figure, well, we'll just leave him in there and we'll pull them out later. And they open up the thing, and there's the tiger, and we're still playing. And everybody goes nuts, of course, because now Steve's turned into a tiger. And as soon as the audience roared and applauded, the tiger got so upset he lost his bowels, or lost his urine, I should say. And he probably dumped like a gallon of tiger piss down onto Steve's head, stuck in the stairwell. And they're still trying to get, and then now they know that's happening because you can smell it everywhere, you know, because male and fat pee. So now they come out and get a crowbar to get the stairwell to come out underneath the thing. They finally get it out and they roll it over the side. And as soon as they get it onto the side of the stage, Steve pops out of there like a jack in the box, and he is screaming mad. And I got to watch all this. I'm playing, you know, because he was supposed to come back on stage, the side of the stage, after we got rid of the cage thing, you know. So I got to watch all this while it was all going on. Oh my God. And none of that's on video, but you can go on YouTube and you can see the actual act with the tiger. It's actually on YouTube.
It's on, the only thing they show you
is the aftermath of Steve coming out of there covered with cat piss. So he had to go and change his shirt and his pants and everything and then come out to do this last little bow, you know.
Oh my gosh.
That's just one of many stories.
And I'm sure he hasn't tried to do anything like that since.
No, not with any live animals, that's for sure. We've done some other kooky things, though. We had a Joker mask that was operated by a little man inside a while back that blew pot, you know, and it was kind of a thing, you know, a Midnight Toker joke. And it was a big, giant-looking, you know, kind of like a, I don't know, the Tubes, you know, or the Genesis, you know, that we kind of kooky stage prop. So we've done a lot of crap. Plus, Steve had a heart attack a couple times on stage, staged on purpose, and we all had to play a role in the act. And he only did that about two or three times because there were some people in the audience that were really upset because they thought he had actually died.
Yeah.
I mean, he came back to life in the act, but they were so upset when they saw him die that they almost had a heart attack themselves. They had to like go to the infirmary or something. So we've done all kinds of kooky stuff.
So before we wrap this up real quick, I just want to ask one last question. What's the band been up to these most recent, you know, the most recent months in the last year with COVID and whatnot, with everything Nothing. Going on, just hanging Nothing. Out?
Like I said, the last gig we had was in Indianapolis in your state in February of last year. And so we have not done any streams. We have not done anything with that band. Now, I've done a lot of streams, and I have my own bands. If you want to come see or hear any of my bands, you could go to Friends Music, F-R-E-N-Z, Z as zebra, music.com. Or my other band with my wife, Barflies with a Z, B-A-R-F-L-Y-Z, music.com. And see the bands that I've, you know, do around here locally. And we were doing streaming all through the spring. I also have a new teaching website that's being developed that'll be up and running here in the next week. And I also have a YouTube channel, Kenny Lee Lewis YouTube channel, where Fret Friends, F-R-E-T, Fret Friends, F-R-E-N-Z, is a lesson program, episodic lessons I have on there. That if you want to hear me performing over the last year doing that stuff, you can hear that. And then my lessons will be attached to those. I also have a book. If you want to go to amazon.com, I have, I'm a novelist. In fact, I just sent my sequel to this book to 16 agents this morning, as a matter of fact. And you can go to amazon.com. I have a book. It's called Skeleton Dolls. And the book that I published on there is called Children of the Tower. And it's on both hard copy and Kindle. And it's a, you know, sci-fi fantasy novel about a pair of twins that speak in twin speak into their adult life, which is, you know, some strange language. I don't know if you've ever known any twins, Devin, but, you know, sometimes identical twins speak in their own language up until about the time they're 4 years old. So, and I happen to know a pair of twins. Of course, it'd be a pair. I know some twins that did that. And I met their mother, and she started telling me all kinds of crazy stories about the way they were when they were little. And so I turned that into a Stephen King kind of Dan Brown novel. And it got received with great success. I self-published it, of course. And it's available on Amazon.com. And like I said, I'm trying to get an agent now interested because I can see that I can write. So I'm going to pursue also a writing career that I would take into my the fall season of my life, you know. So there's some of the things that I've been up to lately. Just want to give my little plug.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to ask what all type of stuff you've been up to personally, and I'll definitely have to check that book out, because I definitely am a huge sucker for Stephen King anything. So if it's inspired, or, you know, it's got some good stuff storyline like a Stephen King, then I'm definitely all for that.
Oh, you'd love this. I mean, all the people that have read it, I mean, I probably only sold 250 copies. I don't know. But the 250 people that read it all love it. I mean, they just can't wait for the next book. And of course, I didn't want to self-publish the next book, because when you do that, the publishers and the agents don't want to talk to you. You know, it's different in the literary world. When you self-publish a book, you've kind of blown it, you know, because they want to be involved in everything, you know, about the artwork, the timing, characters, you know, editing, you know, they want to, because they put a lot of time into it and they don't get paid up front, and they want to make sure it's going to be a hit. Mm-hmm. So you got to bring them fresh meat. Otherwise they don't want to, you know, they want to talk turkey, you know? So, but anyway, my website is KennyLeeLewis.com. Just send me an email there in the contact thing, anybody out there, and I'll be glad to put you on my mailing list. Or if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them and you become a part of my little sphere.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have to do that right after we get out of this. Again, like I said, Kenny, I do appreciate you taking the time of talking with me today. And you said you guys are coming to Indiana here within the next month.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think it's the same bunch of folks. I don't know if it's the same venue, but if you stay in touch with me, or if you go to the stevemillerband.com site on the touring thing, it'll announce that it might already be up there now. I haven't
That's
looked
what I'm, on yeah, I'm site looking well. Now yeah, real quick.
Stevemillerband.com, go to tours and see if they have the Indianapolis gig on there.
It just says Steve Miller Band has been
this June 2021.
June 2021.
Yeah, make sure it's the 2021 list. But if it's not there, then it's probably still not either A, advertised, or it might be a private event. I don't know.
Yeah, it hasn't been. It doesn't look like anything's been.
Okay. All right. Well, let's stay in touch. I'll let you know.
Yeah, I want to stay in touch. Definitely. I definitely want to come out and
When everybody gets vaccinated, I think in the fall, we're probably going to do some more shows. So, and then, of course, 2022 will probably be the year that we hit a full-blown summer tour starting in June.
Absolutely. I'll definitely stay in touch and definitely want to catch up with you guys, if at all possible, out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hang.
Absolutely, man. Like I said, Kenny, it was a huge pleasure talking with you. That story with the whole tiger was definitely...
Like I said, go on YouTube. It's on there. It was called Rock Palast. You want to look up Steve Miller Band 1984, Rock Palast.
Rock Palast. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
All righty, buddy. I appreciate this. You have a good one, Kenny.
The pleasure.